Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos.
Crazy.
Nah, them bongos make me smile every time I hear them. Welcome to episode 144. Firstly, as ever, thank you very much to our Patreon supporters. This podcast would not be able to be produced without them. And although its content is free to everyone, if you like what you hear and you want to make a small donation, go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile. You'll see a Linktree drop-down box. Click on Patreon and that'll show you what to do. It starts at £3 a month, which is pretty much just a cup of coffee, right? But anyway, back to this week's episode. Today, I'm going to introduce you to Madeline Kessler. She's an architect, but not just any architect. She's the architect who co-designed the 2021 British Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. That is some feather to put in your cap, is it not? The Architectural Biennale is on until sometime in November. Maddie gives the precise date in this podcast. And if you're unable to attend this year, Maddie also tells you how you can view a video tour online. I've seen one of them myself and it is damn impressive. Now, I'll give no spoilers to what you're about to hear, but this year's pavilion focuses on repurposing public spaces. And it's pretty amazing the possibilities she makes us aware of. But please come and find out for yourself when I spoke over Zoom with architect Madeline Kessler. I do have several questions that I ask each guest. And one of them is, how would you explain what you do to someone that doesn't know your work?
So I'm an architect and I work with public space. So I'm really interested in the spaces that everyone can access and use. And I suppose my work, it really explores the different scales of architecture in the city. So everything from policy and legislation, right the way down to material detail of sort of a timber seat or something that you sit on.
Oh, wow.
And everything in between, yeah.
Oh, and how did you get into public space as an architect?
It's a good question. I suppose I've always been really interested in people and how people use space. And I think I was always exploring that in my work as a student. And then as I grew into practice, was really lucky to work at some amazing studios, really exploring sort of temporary interventions in public space and how those can kind of really transform spaces at different times of year to allow people to use them in different ways.
Oh, wow.
And through that became really interested in how sort of through really simple design moves and interventions you can make a huge difference to someone's daily life or how they use that space. And I think I'm really interested in also how cities evolve and how it's really important for spaces to kind of evolve and keep sort of transforming and changing, and how you do that in a way that's kind of beneficial to everyone.
How did you have a route into architecture?
So I actually originally studied a structural engineering and architecture degree. When I was at school, I suppose that's when I first heard about architecture. I think I was choosing my A-levels and someone mentioned it to me and I'd never heard of architecture or architects. And I was like, what is that? It's quite a long word. Yeah. And I think I got a bit confused with like archaeology and other things when I was researching it. And then as I looked into it more, I thought, this sounds fascinating. At school, I really loved geography. Like I really loved the human side of geography. Yeah. And people and cities. And I also really liked maths and art. And it just sort of looked like a subject that brought all these different things together. And then I remember I went on an open day to Sheffield University and they mentioned they had this engineering architecture course. And I thought that looked really interesting. And so, yeah, I applied for that and ended up studying that. And then through that course, I was really lucky to be sponsored by an engineering firm who I then worked for in my summer holidays. And I think something I really loved about the course was that it's a vocational degree. So you have that kind of grounding of being in practice, which I've always loved. At the same time as being able to explore things more conceptually within the education. And I do think it's a brilliant degree that I recommend to everyone, because although the kind of full architecture degree is very long, it's sort of 7 years, but you can study the first part for 3 years and you get like a normal degree, which you can go off and do anything. And you learn so many different skills within that degree because it kind of is crossing so many different things. And you take it and explore whatever you want to explore within that. So I've got friends who've gone off and done all sorts of different things from that same degree we studied.
You've sort of reached a point in your career where you've got quite an accolade under your belt at the moment, haven't you?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's been a very surreal kind of 2 years now, actually. So, yeah, I think you're probably sort of referencing the British Pavilion at Venice, which my friend Manajay Verghese and I, we entered a competition back in 2019 now. There's an open call every other year to curate the pavilion there. We won the competition, and ever since then it's just been working on the pavilion, which has been amazing. But it was supposed to open last year, and then with the pandemic it was delayed by a year, and now it's finally open to Venice, the Garden of Privatized Delights. And it's just super exciting to see it up there, to see people exploring it, walking around. And it's been amazing to be able to really explore public space in this kind of quite unique kind of project and way.
Can I just go back a little bit? How was you when you saw or heard that the pair of you had won this open call?
So it's something we look back on and it's, I think our reaction was really odd when I look back. We spent the whole competition thinking this was our test for when we do it properly.
Yeah.
And I think that's something particularly women suffer with. and for some reason we thought, because we've not curated a pavilion before, we wouldn't be able to curate one. But then why would you have curated the British Pavilion for it? It's like a once in a lifetime project. So it's just ludicrous. And we always now say to students and stuff when we're talking to them, just apply for the project and have confidence. Because when we won it, we were just like, are you sure? Like, are you sure you want to give it to us? I mean, I look back and I'm like, yeah, of course we could do it. But I remember when we won it, we were just like, oh my God, like, you know, do they know what they're doing?
Excellent.
But yeah, I mean, it's been a roller coaster over 2 years, and I think it's definitely given us a lot of confidence in the process that we are much more competent than perhaps we thought, and that it is totally possible to create a pavilion if you haven't curated one before. And I think, yeah, it's been amazing. I mean, the whole kind of premise and idea behind the pavilion was to create these series of kind of immersive installations And yeah, we took like sort of wanted to really create these kind of architectural interventions that anyone can go in and interact with. And it's not about having lots of dense text on walls or anything. It's really a place that everyone can sort of walk around and understand and test. And that seems to have been really successful and worked really well. So it's really exciting to see that. Yeah, it's really exciting to see it in action.
And for an architect to be involved with anything in Venice, everything is just beautiful, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a dream of a city. It's just incredible. And I think every time I go there, I always go to the Carini Stampiglia Foundation. It's one of my favourite buildings in the world by Carlo Scarpa, and sort of the basement of that building. It's channeled to allow water in at different levels of the flooding.
Amazing.
And I think it just takes you to another world. And I think that's the amazing thing about architecture and space really. Like, it can just take you into another place and another world and give you that space to reflect and contemplate. And I just love Venice. Like, every corner you turn, you're just kind of, you're in another kind of picturesque, magical place.
Exactly.
And I did finally go out to see the pavilion sort of in June. It opened in May and we couldn't go out because of all the restrictions, but I went in June and it just felt like the most emotional experience because I hadn't left the UK since 2019. And to suddenly be in Venice, like surrounded by all these voices, these smells, like these views, and it's just all so picturesque and your senses are just all on fire.
It's open now, is it?
It is. It's open until the end of November.
And the Garden of Privatised Delights, you are making the viewer or asking the viewer to reconsider their public environments.
Exactly, yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit? I know that there's a certain route that you can go. Could you tell us about the route as soon as you walk up the stairs to the pavilion?
Yeah, so the Garden of Privatised Delights, it's sort of inspired by a painting by Hieronymus Bosch called The Garden of Earthly Delights. And the exhibition is created by myself and Manjay Verghese, and we sort of took this painting actually right at the beginning from our competition, and we really loved how it was set up as a triptych. And so you sort of have heaven on the left and hell on the right, and then this middle ground in between.
Yeah.
And the painting's absolutely amazing, all these incredible forms in it and colours. And then we took that painting and we reinterpreted it as a way to look at privatised public space. So we're looking at how often you kind of, it's set up so you look at private as evil, public as heaven, and then actually we're all living in this middle ground in between. So how do we navigate this weird middle ground of public-private that we're all living in today? And that's what the pavilion is. So as you enter the pavilion, you're entering into that middle ground and you immediately encounter the Garden of Delight. So you encounter this garden square and all you can see are these railings and planting, and you can see there's something behind, but you can't access it. And you're forced to continue around the entire pavilion until you find yourself back inside that garden square. And that's really setting up the issue of privatized public space, that it's not accessible to everyone, that often you need a key or, you know, you need to be in the club to gain access. And therefore, how do we break down these physical and intangible and intangible barriers? How do we allow everyone to be able to access our privatized public spaces? And then as you continue through the pavilion, you're sort of taken on this journey where you follow the garden path through sort of your British town or city. And then you can step off the path in places. So you go through sort of the pub, the high streets, sort of the youth centre, looking at places in the city for teenagers and young people. And then we've got these two ministry rooms, which are sort of exploring the policy behind access to public space. So one of them's looking at sort of facial recognition technology and ownership of data. And the other one's looking at sort of citizens' assemblies and ownership of, how we can have more kind of collective ownership over common lands. And then we've also got our sort of surprise seventh room in the basement of the British Pavilion, which is looking at public toilets. And so it's opening up the toilet in the basement of the pavilion, which many people don't know exists.
Excellent.
And putting that on display. And yeah, just really looking at how it's well and good to have really lovely sort of public spaces in our cities, but unless you've got the infrastructure to allow everyone to use them, they're not really accessible to everyone. So, you know, unless you've got free toilets and drinking fountains and free seating for people to use, you're excluding people from those spaces.
Yeah. I mean, you, when you go up and in and you've got those railings in front of you and you can't access that space beyond the railings, there's, if you're in London, you'll know lots of those private squares that that you may well come across. And yeah, I've always felt quite envious of those that have got access to some of those gardens, you know.
And many of them, they were originally surrounded by residential properties, but obviously now many of them are just surrounded by offices and stuff, and they are completely empty, like in the daytime. I mean, where Manajé and I studied the Architectural Association, that's around one of these garden squares. And although the university had like a key to the square, like it was just a massive faff to get hold of it. No one ever knew where it was. So we'd all sit eating our lunch like on the pavement around the square, and the square was completely empty. But interestingly, in the Second World War, they melted a lot of the railings around the square.
Oh, wow.
Because they, well, it was under the pretense it was going to be used for ammunition, but in fact, that didn't happen. But what happened was all these squares opened up for the public to use for the first time. And there are sort of texts and stuff from the time, you know, from people talking about how amazing it was to be able to suddenly meet people in these squares. And then after the war, English Heritage reinstated many of those railings, and that's when some of them became publicly accessible, but many of them were kind of closed off again.
I mean, you mentioned the second area you mentioned there was the pub. I mean, the demise of the British pub has, it's been so noticeable over the past maybe 10 years, with a shift in the drinking culture, as well as the super high taxes that goes on top of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really sad. And I think even sadder is when you see everything just getting converted to residential properties, especially on the high street as well. And, you know, actually the importance of having these kind of social centres. I mean, the pub is, I mean, that's what that room is exploring. It's much more than just the pub. It's much more than just a watering hole. You know, it's especially in rural areas, it's like, you know, real community hubs. And how do we therefore sort of reinvent the pub for the 21st century to go beyond that? And I think over the past year, where we saw kind of the first time ever every single pub in the UK close due to lockdowns. I think in places they, you know, there were reports of like increases in alcoholism because, you know, if people are just drinking at home rather than in a pub where you're in quite a controlled environment. It saw sort of real increases in that. So often people think the pub is the cause of alcoholism, but it isn't quite that simple. No. And I think that's what a lot of our pavilion is exploring, like these issues. They're not very simple black and white issues. And increasingly everyone sort of wanting to see the world in black and white. And it's like that. That's just not it. It's a really grey area. And how do we therefore explore that? And yeah, just like you're saying, like pubs are super important parts of,
well, the pub that was on our estate where I live. It was taking so little money, it started just opening of an evening. So then it had the quandary of what it'd done of a daytime. So of a daytime, they tried opening up the quieter bar, the saloon bar, as like a mother and toddler meeting place, you know. Yeah, that seemed to be working. So they was trying to sort of repurpose the building, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there are quite a few pubs now opening up creches and yoga studios and all sorts in them. Because, yeah, like you say, like they're great spaces. You've got these really huge spaces that you can use quite flexibly.
And the public toilet being the last room, I did notice it had some window looking out of the toilet or looking into the toilet even.
Yeah, so, I mean, the toilet as well, I mean, part of that sort of came about because Manajé and I, we originally taught a summer school together in 2015 about the pub. And part of that was because we were looking at how the pub's almost like the modern day public toilet. Like, and with the closure of the pub, you're sort of seeing the closure of that facility as well. And then became quite interested in public toilets and the closure of them. And, you know, why was the pub suddenly becoming the public toilet? And there's actually been, you know, huge lack of funding in public toilets for years. And it's something that's just not really spoken about because it's just not like a very sexy topic for people And there's no regulations out there or anything to say that councils need to provide them. And when their budgets are kind of slashed, they just tend to get rid of them. And so we were really interesting. We went over when the Art Biennale in 2019 was being installed after we won the competition. And the British Pavilion was this massive social hub. And we're like, what's going on? And it's because they've got toilets in the basement and they're one of the few pavilions in the Giardini which has toilets. Brilliant. I'm like, this is fascinating. Like, you know, it just shows like why the toilet's so, so important. And so we wanted to open up the toilet for everyone to be able to use. And through that process, we're hit with a lot of red tape because the existing toilets in the pavilion, they don't quite meet Italian building regulations. Yeah. Like they're not fully accessible. So if you're disabled, you can't access them, or in a wheelchair, you can't access them. They aren't like sort of hooked up to the cistern tanks in the right way and things like that. So as a result, we weren't allowed to open them up to the public, but what we could do was put them on display, which is what we've done instead.
Brilliant.
So there are three toilets down there. So we've put one on display so that the invigilators can still use the other two. And that's been painted in this toxic yellow, toxic green, which is kind of the antithesis of the Bosch painting. Designer did loads of research into pigments behind this painting and came up with this toxic green, which is like the antithesis of that. Yeah, so opened up the shutters so that anyone walking past can look in. And then we've got these photos on the walls by this amazing guy called Mark. And he, yeah, he's put these photos on the walls of just all these public toilets he's documented across London and sort of, yeah, just showing all the different types of public toilets so there are and how inadequate a lot of them are.
And they're being repurposed as well, aren't they? If they're not being knocked down, they're being repurposed.
Exactly, yeah. Many of the Victorian ones are being repurposed and stuff. But so Mark Freeman, he sort of did his whole dissertation on public toilets. And what he found was many of the toilets which are still in use, they're just not adequate. So, you know, when you see those ones with shutters going all the way around, yeah, kind of oval shaped, they've kind of got a weight limit on them. So if you're in a wheelchair or your family going in, you'll set off the weight limit and it'll spray you water and stuff. or if you're in there for over 20 minutes, he like tested out, he was in there for over 20 minutes and suddenly, you know, like all these alarms go off and stuff.
Well, that was the big, big scare when they first came about 20 or so years ago, was that people would be sitting there doing what they're doing and the door would open to the, to the public while you're sat there.
And then you've got like the old Victorian ones, which, you know, like many of them are starting to now be converted into bars and stuff and other things. But yeah, it leads you to wonder why they can't be converted back into toilets perhaps as well.
I come from a town in the west of Essex, East London border called Dagenham. And there was a massive big public toilet in a place called The Fiddlers, which was named after the pub on the big roundabout there. They had a male and a female attendant. So it was obviously costing the local council, you know, some monies. And they were subterranean, like most toilets are. What would that be for? Would that be for discretion, do you think?
I think it was just in the Victorian times when they started to build all the toilets, they started to go underground, I guess, because of space partly at street level and also probably for discretion. Yeah. And it, I mean, it does mean that there's problems with accessibility and stuff if you were to reopen them now. But
they knocked those down, or I suppose filled them in. And then for some reason, they built another one maybe 60 metres away that was a lot smaller, that looks like a house or a shop even. That was a toilet for about 5 years. And now it's a cab office.
That's interesting. I mean, I found it really interesting when I was doing research into public toilets as well, because in the Victorian era, they were often only built for men. So women were really left on a urinary leash. And then Selfridges was one of the first places to provide public toilets for women, because they realised that women couldn't actually venture out to their store without being near enough to a toilet. And they realized that therefore if they were to provide public toilets, they could get more customers coming.
Brilliant. Mr. Selfridge was quite good at publicity, wasn't he?
I just thought it was quite interesting, this kind of relationship between public, private, and how do you, I think sort of King's Cross have got some really good new public toilets in that Argent development, which anyone can use. And I suppose it's just like, how do we work with public and private to allow these kind of more public uses, which are really important?
And the thing is, some of those old Victorian ones are absolutely beautiful, aren't they?
Yeah, the tiling and stuff.
Who'd have thought so, eh?
I mean, the Victorians just, I think there was just this real civic pride, particularly with their infrastructure, which somehow has gone wayward and we've lost in between. But I am hopeful it's coming back. We need to get that kind of pride over our infrastructure and craft back again. But everything from like a drain pipe to a street lamp, you know, just the amount of craft and detail that went into it all. And I think what Victorians did so well was thinking about your experience at ground floor level. So when you're just a member of the public passing by, like what your experience is over these kind of very everyday objects. And so, yeah, using infrastructure, I suppose, as a way to sort of bring joy to places.
Well, it does start with people like yourselves, architects for public spaces, that sort of push the boundaries a little bit or want to try something new or even, you know, reflecting back on the past in a retrospective manner.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely, I think something as well that's really important is just to try new things and test new things. And I think increasingly us, like society and our public sectors, have become quite sort of risk averse. And everyone's very scared about getting sued or blamed for things. And we kind of need to bring back this culture of it's okay to test things and it's okay to fail as long as you learn from that and you're kind of progressing from that. And I think it's really important to be like trying things in new ways. And I think that's where like sort of temporary installations can be really important because they allow you that flexibility to really push and test things in new ways, whether that be new materials or a new way of like using a space. And that's what each of these interventions are doing. They're these kind of ways to test the spaces in different ways. But also I've explored in sort of different parts of my work, for example, like making seats out of mushrooms or mycelium, and that the Oslo Architecture Triennale to understand how we could start to use different building materials. Whereas if you're on a very big, large project, it's much harder to test those things in sort of a very quick way and get that kind of feedback loop going.
What I love about London is that you can have something from maybe the 18th, 19th century next to something that is 10 years old, and they just sit perfectly next to each other. Yeah, it really is quite warming of respecting the old and welcoming the new, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think London is a very unique city. Unique because it's got so many green spaces, unique because it's got that kind of real history behind it. And like you're saying, there's also like some really exciting projects going on. And I think often people say, like, why does it take so long to train as an architect? And, you know, I think part of it is because actually when you're designing a building or a place like that, that's going to be there for a really long time.
You've got one attempt at getting it right.
It's really important to get it right. And there's so much that goes into it. You know, these projects are really important to get right, and they're going to evolve and grow. And, you know, yeah, as you were just saying, like, if you don't get it right, then also the city's stuck with it because you know, and increasingly there's a big move to sort of demolish less because of the environment and, you know, to refurbish more, which means that any big project will be there for even longer. I think that it is a very kind of important and unique thing. But I'd also say that sort of what goes into making a building or a place, it is much more than just an architect and their vision. Like, it's a real collaborative team effort between so many different people. And, you know, it's like you have like really good planners and planning authorities and consultants, like local communities. Like, there's so many different bits to this kind of puzzle to make it kind of work and become a success.
You can see that's very relevant in the pavilion. Because you can see that the different types of materials used. You've even got a playground there for teenagers.
Yeah, so that room's designed by VPR Architects and it's called Play Without Grounds. And that's all about creating spaces in the city for young people and teenagers and how there's just nowhere for them to play anymore or go and hang out. And often actually what you see is people providing sort of very active spaces for teenagers, like skateboard parks and basketball courts. But you've also got a lot of teenagers. So I was definitely one of them who just wanted to sit around with their mates and just talk and not really do anything. And as soon as teenagers do that, they're seen as a threat.
How do you
actually provide spaces for them to feel like they belong and they can occupy? And within that room, there are sort of these speakers which play conversations with teenagers talking about the spaces they'd like to see in their cities and a lot of them talking about how they just don't feel welcome anywhere and things like that. And it's all about how do you sort of design with teenagers rather than for them. And yeah, I think that's like a theme that's sort of running throughout the pavilion, really. It's all about how do we design with local communities, like rather than making sweeping assumptions. You know, there's no one size fits all model. It's about sort of working together to create sort of these locally specific kind of interventions.
Excellent. I love it.
Yeah, there's another really exciting project actually called the People's Pavilion, being led by Beyond the Box Consultants, which we've been working a little bit on with some workshops with them. And that's designing a pavilion in the Olympic Park, which is going to open at the end of August. And it'll be like the first, I think they're saying it's the first space that will be designed, built and curated by teenagers in London.
Excellent.
Which is amazing, and it just shows like that this is possible and it can happen. And I think it's just really exciting because I think increasingly there's just been this like them versus us kind of mentality. It's like, no wonder you get gang problems, no wonder if people don't feel welcome in their cities and their places,
they make up their own rules, don't they?
Exactly. And you know, also this is the future, like our young people are our future, and I think they've got so many amazing things to say, particularly when it comes to like climate change and stuff, like they're so on it. And yeah, I think that it's really important that we are designing spaces with them and giving, you know, helping them and assisting them, I suppose, to reclaim these parts of their city.
And has the pandemic or COVID been recognised within the pavilions this year at Venice?
Yeah, I mean, within our own pavilion, we had finished fabricating all the main kind of installations just before the first lockdown last year. So we had this very weird moment where we went to see all the installations, thought they were about to go to Venice, and then they just went into storage for a year.
Wow.
So they're physically, they're the same, but what has changed is the messaging behind them has evolved, and we've got a lot of sound and audio within our pavilion, which has completely evolved. And I think none of the topics that we're exploring have dramatically changed. They've just been pushed to the forefront of the conversation. So, you know, the decline of the high street and the pub, which we're exploring, like these have always been important topics to us, but over the past year I think everyone's kind of really engaged in these kind of topics even more. And I think that's the same for a lot of the pavilions in Venice at the moment. They're all kind of exploring topics which are really important to their countries right now. And I think COVID has kind of led to a kind of even more renewed kind of interpretation of how important it is to be addressing these topics. So the overriding kind of question that the whole Biennale asks is, how will we live together? Which, again, obviously that was announced before the pandemic, but it's even more important now, how will we actually all live together? And you've got the selection of pavilions this year is amazing. I mean, you've got the Danish pavilion, which is looking at water and flooding in Venice, and they've kind of created this installation where you can play in the water, but also throughout this installation it purifies the water, so by the end you can have a cup of tea from this water that they've drilled from the ground.
Their pavilion was quite stunning this in 2019, for the arts.
Yeah, I think Denmark always do a really good job. And you've got Polish pavilion that's looking at sort of rural areas as well, and sort of rural decline, and you know, how do we actually engage with that, and sort of all this rural architecture. And then the Belgian pavilion, which has got all these amazing models in it. So in Belgium, it's they've sort of set up where there's this government scheme to really encourage and allow younger architects to take on these like fairly like mid-sized housing projects that doesn't really happen here. And it's just showing the kind of exciting results of that and how positive that's been. And then the American pavilion sort of exploring timber housing. And it, you know, how ubiquitous this kind of timber framed housing is in America, and no one's really talking about it. Everyone's talking about timber being the future of construction, and they're like, well, it's already happening, what can we learn from this? And they've built this huge kind of timber framed kind of structure outside their facade that you can climb up and get amazing views across the Giardini as well.
Brilliant.
But yeah, I mean, it's just all sorts of different topics being explored. I really love the Uzbekistan pavilion as well, which is sort of looking at the traditional kind of Uzbek compound houses. And how these kind of communal houses are starting to be lost, and how can we kind of retain this community spirit? And then also the UAE Pavilion, they're looking at kind of, I suppose, more materiality, but they've created the structure using kind of dead material from the sea. And it's really beautiful. Yeah, it's really beautiful. And it's like really strong, the kind of structural component they've made from it, just using all these minerals that otherwise would have just been completely lost. It's just amazing, I think, because it's the Biennale is just exploring everything from policy and legislation to kind of materiality, and therefore all these different ways that we can be working together to live together.
Was there something with a Korean architect who brought everyone together?
Yeah, there is. So we're doing a load of events actually at the end of August with her. So Hai Won, she's brought together this curators collective, which is essentially an opportunity for all the curators to get to know one another. And it started off quite informally by setting up just like a series of Zoom calls between us, which was quite amazing because everyone's based all over the world. And you'd have these like really lovely Zoom calls getting to know one another. And then we would go into these breakout sessions depending on our interests. And out of that, there's then been a few projects. So one of them is this Midasage event that's being organised by the Austrian Pavilion at the end of August, which will be a load of different kind of conversations and stuff throughout the Biennale. And then another one was organised by the UAE Pavilion, which was this bench competition for students to enter. And they're going to build, we were judging it the other week, and we've selected sort of these three benches, which are going to be built throughout the Giardini, which is firstly a lovely gesture because it allows more people to sit on free seating, but all the benches are really interesting designs from these amazing students around the world. And I think the Curators Collective have actually been like a really kind of amazing thing to be a part of, because I think normally you're quite kind of isolated and only really know your little bubble and your little world. And it's been an amazing way actually to get to know all these other people from around the world. And previously we'd go out to Venice for these kind of events where they get every kind of pavilion to stand up and just talk about what their pavilion was about, but only people from Europe could really attend these events, whereas this is something which you can attend no matter where in the world you are.
Well, I like the idea that it was curator-led and not something that was part of the structure of the Biennale, you know? It's obviously more organic that way, isn't it? And you take sort of possession of what's happening.
Exactly, yeah, and you can take real ownership over it and do whatever you want within it. Like, yeah, it just comes down to people who are being great.
You're saying about park bench, you didn't say park benches, you said benches. I've always had quite an affiliation with the bench. Sometimes you can sit on a bench. I know I sound like a fucking old man here, but sometimes you can sit on a bench and you just think, did they make this for me? Because it is so comfortable. It's just slats of wood, but the shape is ideal, you know?
I know. I think benches are really underrated. Like, I think they're so important in allowing access to space as well, like free seating. It's so important. And I agree, like, it allows for spaces to contemplate, spaces to meet people. Like, they're such important kind of parts of our public space.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the reasons there's like a big bench right outside our pavilion is my grandma. She became like the person we go to with our pavilion development, because it's really good to have someone cast their eyes over a project who's not an architect and knows nothing about architecture. And her first comment was just, where will I sit? Where will I sit as I'm going around? Yeah. And my favourite people to discuss any of my projects with are non-architects. Because they will just like ask a question and like just cuts through. And it's great. So
saying that about benches as well, this is a little bit negative, but when I started seeing councils like retrofitting arms in the middle of benches, and then I've discovered that was just to stop homeless people laying down on the benches, you know, or putting these little, I don't know what they're called, like little spear tops, little pyramids all about the place. Oh man, that breaks my heart when I see.
It's so awful. So that's called hostile design, and it's really awful. And that actually, there was a really good campaign by Stuart Semple, the artist. Yeah.
That's what made me aware of it.
Yeah. So his hashtag hostile design campaign, that really inspired our pavilion, actually.
Brilliant.
And it's quite amazing when you go to Bournemouth and you can see where they've actually removed those kind of armrests. Because yeah, there's absolutely no need to do that. And it's not fixing any problem. It's just moving a problem on. And it's not addressing any of the kind of root causes of an issue. And it's making our cities like just exclusive. You know, why shouldn't someone who's homeless be able to sleep on a bench? No one wants to, you know, it's just, I agree with you. I completely agree. It's completely horrible, that kind of architecture. And there's definitely a big move at the moment to try and get councils and people to realise that this is not a solution and we shouldn't be doing this.
But someone's designing those as well. It's like, how can they sleep of a night, you know?
And they're probably making a fortune from it as well.
I could imagine. I could imagine. But it was, it was Stuart Semple. I didn't understand why. That didn't even enter my mind. That, it was to stop people laying down. And, I got behind Stuart and gave him my support, that was for sure. And at the same time, I saw that maybe the guy in Canada done this because of Stuart's thing, but it was at that exact time, there was this guy in Canada, he'd made this thing on the back of a park bench, which was like a flap. It was made for the homeless people so that they could lay on the bench. This flap would come over and it would be like a roof. In rough weather, you know.
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
That's pretty cool, isn't it?
That's really cool. I love that. We need more things like that. I think Stuart's super interesting as well, because I went down last weekend to his exhibition opening, because he's just converted the Bobby's Debenhams into a gallery on the high street in Bournemouth. And I think it's really interesting how he's transforming like this high street space into something that's really cultural that anyone can access and use. But I totally agree with you about the hostile design stuff and it also being an issue that people aren't aware it's happening. And so therefore, how do we actually raise everyone's awareness of this? Because as a member of the public, you've actually got quite a lot of say over what happens in your city and your surroundings, but often it's very difficult to realise that you have that kind of power.
Giving local governments a little bit of guilt goes quite a long way, isn't it? Because they don't want to be seen as hostile, do they, you know?
I think that was what was great about the sticker campaign, like just, making it really, really public and shaming them.
Yeah, good. I mean, I've got to say, I was speaking to a couple of friends mentioning that we're going to be talking on the podcast. And I did say I was quite intimidated to be speaking to an architect because it's a little bit out of my comfort zone. And then I come across the video of your pavilion.
Yeah.
And I saw no difference between that and an art installation, you know. I'm not just saying it because you're here, but I thought it was absolutely stunning. I wish I could go out there. I thought it was amazing.
Thank you. I mean, I have to say, like, I think a big kind of driver was that we didn't want it to be like your traditional architecture exhibition. Like, we didn't want it to be a place that people don't feel comfortable going into, because this needs to be a conversation about everyone, which everyone is a part of. And so we made a really conscious effort to sort of not have too much text on the walls, not have like too many images or precedents or anything on the walls. It's really about these kind of installations, and we were really inspired by the Art Biennale and how artists, like, they are just so brave in a way to just actually allow these kind of objects that everyone can sort of just interpret. And so it's really lovely to hear that was what you felt from watching the videos.
It felt like an experience, although it was only video. It did feel like it was an experience I was participating in, you know.
That's brilliant to hear. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what we want people to feel, that they are part of this conversation. And then to get everyone excited that everyone can be part of this conversation. Because like you say, I think people are often put off by it's like a very kind of complex world and, you know, architecture, that's not for me. And it's, you know, we're trying to say, actually, there's room for everyone to be involved in this conversation. Yeah. And it's really important. Everyone is actually, it makes it much richer. And I think traditionally there has been this thing of like the lone genius architect who doesn't relate to people. And I think we're kind of trying to do the complete opposite of that. And, we've brought in so many different voices into the pavilion and stuff, because it is a really collaborative kind of project.
I was going to say, for anyone who won't be able to visit in person, would you be able to direct them to that video?
Yes. So if you'd like to find out more about the pavilion, if you go to the British Council's website, there's actually a series of videos.
Oh, I saw just one. On
there's an overview. Yeah, there's an overview video of the tour, and then you can actually click to go into more detail in each of the rooms. And learn more about the research behind each of the rooms. But yeah, on the British Council's website, so there's loads of information about the pavilion. And also, yeah, we're hoping to do a few more things which will be released on there soon. So yeah, keep checking back.
And when is the pavilion opened until physically people are able to get there?
It's open until the end of November. So yeah, there is still time to make it out there. And then we're sort of looking right now at what we do with its afterlife. So, but we'd always envisaged that each of these installations would come back to a public space within the UK. So, yeah, we'll keep you updated.
Oh, that's pretty cool. And yeah, congratulations on this little feather in your cap. It's quite something to have, yeah?
Thank you. I mean, do you think you'll make it out to Venice?
I very much doubt it. I'd wanted to go to the Biennale for years and years, and I was only able to go just this year. And that was a 50th birthday gift from a friend.
It's been a funny old year, because it's a shame that the restrictions are as they are, but hopefully there'll be time before November.
Well, congratulations to you. And what have you got planned after November? Is there anything in the pipeline for you?
Yes, we're quite busy. So got working on a project in South Lambeth, opening up a piece of private land to the public.
Nice.
Working on Gingerbread City with Museum of Architecture, which is an exhibition that will run in Chicago from November, and I'm master planning all these gingerbread islands, which is really fun.
Brilliant.
And yeah, working on some workspace designs and all sorts of projects. So yeah, it's been a really busy year, which is exciting. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Well, Madeline, thank you very much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary. Really appreciate
Cheers,
it.
Madeline.
Thank you. Bye.
There you are, Madeline Kesler. That was something a little bit special, wasn't it? And as she mentioned there, you can view the video tour over on the British Council's website. Or if you'd like day-to-day updates, go over to Maddie's Instagram profile, which is Maddie_Tesla_. And I'd like to thank Tanny Burns of T Burns Arts for connecting me with Maddie. So that's about it from me today. So until next week, toodle pip. Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. If you're unable to support us on Patreon, leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to this podcast really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast, or even giving us a positive shout out on your social media. Anything is appreciated, but either way, thanks for listening, and until next week, ta-da.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.